name is David Reske, CEO of Now Speed Marketing, and welcome to this edition of In the Now, where we focus on uncovering the myths and misunderstandings of marketing and leadership with some of the world's most interesting people. And my guest today is Mike Volkin. Mike is a public speaker, a scale coach, a serial entrepreneur, Army veteran, award-winning author. He has built and sold 6 companies and helped over 400 companies scale using principles derived from his proprietary business success formula. And he's, and I think you, Mike, you've got a recent new book about the business success formula as well. So
I do.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Welcome to the show. So, you know, with your background, we could talk about a lot of different ideas related to marketing and entrepreneurship. But I wanted to key in an idea that you and I have been talking about from the business success formula. And I'd like to frame it in this format of the Mythbuster question. And the myth you and I were talking about was, in order to create a successful business, you've got to have a unique idea to win. Is that true or not true?
That myth has been busted. A lot of entrepreneurs come to me. I'm an entrepreneur coach, and they come to me saying, I've always wanted to own a business. I can't think of anything unique. I've been struggling for years. I need your help ideating a new business model. And my first question is, why? Why do you want to ideate something new? That's just like another roadblock you have to deal with. Why not start a business that you know something about, you know, something else is already out there and has a proven business model and you can put your own twist on it or spin on it. So no, it's certainly don't need a new business idea to go to market. There's thousands, millions of copycats across the world.
But isn't it easier if you got some kind of a brand new, unique idea? Nobody's ever done this before. Is it easier to kind of like win the market and like you're going to become the next billionaire?
Well, there is an advantage to being first to market, first mover's advantage, right? But that, you know, once you become successful, even moderately successful, it's going to get ripped off big time. I mean, look how quick Lyft came along after Uber launched, right? It was just a matter of months. So, it's always better, not always, but in many cases, it's better, with the exception of products like technology-related products. You know, if you wanted to start a business and you especially haven't started a business before in the past, do something that has already proven to make money that you can put your own spin on and your own brand on and go to market with it. And you will find a lot less resistance to becoming a customer rather than starting your own company. I mean, look, if you start your own business model, if you start your own business model and it's a unique service or product and you now have an education layer before you have to make the sale, you have to teach people what it is that your product or service does, and then you have to make the sale. So if a customer has seen the product or service before, it's just that much easier. It's yet another layer that you don't have to peel back before making the sale.
Yep. That makes a lot of sense. Now, Business 101 would say that you do want to look for competitive advantage or strategic competitive advantage. You want to look at, you know, what's your customers, and I actually teach this in a course that I teach, but it, you know, look at, you know, the customer's key purchase criteria, look at what you do well, look at what your competitors are doing well or poorly, and look for those opportunities. Should you still look for competitive advantage if you're doing a me too idea? And where are those sources of competitive advantage if you're doing an idea that's already been done before?
It always helps to have a competitive advantage, but it certainly isn't required. I mean, in this case, let's say that I want to do a copycat business, I don't know, a house cleaning service, right? And they don't have any in my area. It's just a matter of getting somebody's mind first before anybody else comes into their mind and takes their business. So, you know, let's take freelancing, for example. As a consultant, I freelance all the time. And it doesn't necessarily mean I'm always, when I win the job, the best candidate for the job. I was just the first person that met all their criteria, you know, price, experience, and then they hired me. So it's not always having a competitive advantage is required. It's just a matter of getting in the hearts and minds of person that you want to sell to first before anybody else does. Also, speaking of competitive advantage, a lot of people default to, well, I could just do this for cheaper. That seems to be the easiest thing to do is, well, how can I get this for cheaper? How can I sell it for cheaper? You have to hire a cheaper talent or source a cheaper product. And ultimately, you're going to be upset with a business that scales when you have a value platform as being cheaper. You're going to be working for smaller profits. You're going to be having a tougher time with culture in your company because your employees will be working less with less benefits. There's a lot of drawbacks that come to, you know, having a service or product that's cheaper than your competitors. And honestly, I have found if you can position yourself correctly from a marketing communication standpoint, it really doesn't matter what price you're at. I mean, I'm $300 an hour and I go to my clients that are startups that can't rub two nickels together, and I'm closing deals with them because they know that it's going to be a positive return on their investment if they hire me. They're going to be, as opposed to hiring a strategist, a marketing strategist for $40 an hour or 60 or whatever, they're going to pay that extra money because I told them about my experience. I've convinced them that I can do the job. And they, instead of seeing it as an expense, they now put it in the investment category. So that's how you really build a business, is that if people can save money, they can save time, or they can make money, you will win their heart and mind. Those are the three things: save time, save money, make money. Those are the three things that consumers and businesses care about.
So it's really about execution more than it is that radical new idea. So let's talk about the elements of execution. So in your business success formula, do you kind of talk about some of those elements of execution that are required? Because you can't just have a copycat idea and bad execution and be the most expensive. You can't not have all those things. Like what is the secret to kind of launching a business and being successful?
Yeah. So I just want to put this in context for everybody. Business Success Formula is my book. For those who are listening, I'm holding it up on the screen right now. So this is from my experience of working with hundreds of companies, the companies that fail, the companies that succeed. What are the key differentiators? And I actually put it in a mathematical formula. So to answer your question, execution is a large part of it. It's in the performance part of the formula. But let me just give you the formula first. And I'll explain this. I'm going to say it first. I'm going to explain it. It's T plus P plus B plus I plus M equals business success. So it's talent plus performance plus brand plus innovation and money, I and M, equals business success. Now, of that formula, talent is the most heavily weighted portion of the formula. It's 1.5 times what every other part is. Innovation and money are together. They comprise of 25% of the formula. So when you, and the way you turn that into math is that this book has 160 questions, 168, where you rank yourself between 1 and 10. And then you take each subcategory, you now have a number, an average number, and you plug it into that formula, and you can see where your weaknesses and your strengths are as a company. So that's how the formula works. But the execution comes from the performance part, which actually has the most questions to answer in that formula because there's a lot to execution. I've worked with companies that, how do I put this nicely, are micromanagers, where every single thing has to be deliberated between everybody before anything is executed, and they never get anything done. But when they do, it's perfect. But by that time it's released, it's too late. And then I work with business owners on the flip side of that, where they don't want to know anything. They're just like, let's just launch it and see what happens. That's the flip side of that. So you want to have a nice middle there where it's not quite micromanager. It's not quite just throw it in there to the wall and see what sticks. So there's a fine line between how to execute something without being a micromanager and without being sloppy.
You know, I could see how like that can make a huge, that the formula makes a huge difference. And I could see that as a very powerful diagnostic for a mid-size or larger company. So you can kind of think about all those different elements, right? The talent that you've got, you can evaluate that. You can evaluate your performance, client satisfaction, you know, customer repeat business, your brand. You can measure all of that. Let's back it up to the startup. Let's say you're working with a startup. Where should they put their focus? Do they have to do all these things, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, all five of these things really well in order to be successful? Do they have to, should they start in one place rather than another? Kind of where do they start on your formula of five things?
Yeah, really good question. So you're right. The business success formula is designed for people with 10 or more employees. Now, when we go to startup, so the reason why a lot of people in the startup world read this book is because they have to be aware, if they're going to scale their company, of the issues that they're going to be facing and the questions that they're eventually going to have to answer in this formula. So just being aware of that, they are able to make smarter decisions where they go. But to answer your question, of that formula for a startup, I don't want to say completely ignore the branding aspect of it, but people really overestimate what a brand would do for a startup. A lot of times entrepreneurs will come to me with barely even a business idea, and they're just like laboring over this logo and this color scheme. And they don't understand that it takes 7 years to build a brand, and that even if you have 1,000 customers or 10,000 customers, you still don't have a brand that people recognize and can say, oh, that logo is that company. They don't, people, entrepreneurs just, they like to think big, but they go big too early. So don't worry about the brand so much. The talent on who you hire can make or break your company early. And that goes all the way, quote unquote, down to freelancers and consultants who aren't even working with you full time. I mean, if you are a startup and you don't even have any employees and you want a really good quality A player talent, don't go cheap. Do your research. Don't bother checking references. Those are just fluff pieces anyway. I've never really liked references, right? But you want to go into a company like Upwork and look at the reviews and see the similar jobs that have been done. Look at their job success score on Upwork. See if it's, you know, 80% or 100%. There's a big difference there. And really deep dive into their history and make sure it's relevant to what you need. But the other part of that is the communication and culture aspect of a freelancer and a consultant. You guys really have to be aligned. For example, I prefer not to use Slack quite a bit because it goes against everything that I know for proper execution in a business. Slack is a productivity killer. You got messages dinging on your phone and pop-ups coming on your computer. You can't stay focused, right? So if a client comes to me and say, we use Slack, usually that's a red flag for me and saying, don't work with them. But now I do work on Slack, but I tell them right up front, this is how I communicate. I'll use Slack, but I'll check it twice a day, in the morning and in the evening, because this is the way I work. I use a Pomodoro technique. I say focus for 40 minutes. I take a 10-minute break. I say focus for 40 minutes. I take a 10-minute break. Those breaks are where I check my email, get something to drink, whatever. So from a culture aspect, when you're hiring people, you have to know and align with how they communicate and accept it. Doesn't have to be the same way they communicate with you, but as long as you have expectations of boundaries, then that's fine. I'm not going to be a slave to my phone or my pop-ups on my computer, or I'll never get anything done, because I get like 250 emails a day, let alone all the notifications that pop up on WhatsApp and Slack and Skype and all these other programs that are available now, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I think I counted it up. I use 8 different messaging tools, and it's insane. Like, it's insane. Yeah. So coming back to your formula, so you're a startup, talent is the most important thing, probably in the mid-sized company. Does it change as you grow? You got a company, let's say you've gone from startup to 25 people to 50 people. Now you've got 10 million in revenue, you got 30 million in revenue, you're kind of growing up. Does the emphasis change in talent? Can you get away with worse talent where you're investing more in innovation or anything like that? Or is talent
really good question? So the biggest pivots come for when, number one, a CEO or an owner of a company wants to step away from the daily operations of the company and hire managers or C-level execs to take over the other talent that's they're currently managing. That's a big pivot. And then the other pivot is when those directors or managers hire managers underneath them. So every one of those increases in scaling require a revamp of how HR, human resources, or the managers hire talent and what they expect of the talent, right? So there are major pivots along that point, but ultimately, fundamentally, everything should be focused around getting the best possible players, quote unquote, employees, freelancers, consultants that you can. And it doesn't always have to be about money. I know very high level execs at Silicon Valley major companies that will leave their company to go to another company for less money because the culture is better, the benefits are better, the opportunity for advancement is better, right? So don't think it's all about the money. You don't hire the most expensive person you can and think that that's going to be the best person for you. That has nothing, that has very little to do with the overall formula of hiring the right talent.
Yep. So execution, getting the right talent is really critical to win. But let's come back to this, you know, this Mythbuster question we were talking about in the beginning, that you need the unique idea to win. We debunked that myth, but you did include innovation in your success formula. What is the role of innovation? And is it about creating a unique idea, or is it about creating, doing something else? What does that innovation buy you when you're building a company? Yeah,
that's a good question. I mean, a lot of people think when I say innovation, it means let's just stick a clock in it and that's innovating, you know, innovating the product is now to tell time. But innovation is not only about product tweaks and service tweaks, about making it different or adopting AI into something, right? Innovation is about how your company innovates ideas or empowers its employees. So I'll give you an example. Like one of the companies that I work with or used to work with had an intrapreneur. It's a kind of a new rising position within companies. An intrapreneur is almost like an entrepreneur within a company, an intrapreneur. And their job is innovation. So they wanted to empower everyone from the C-level execs all the way down to the person answering the phones at the front desk to have ideas about how they can help customers, the product, even the workplace, the lunch ordering process, anything that would improve and innovate the company in any way that would propel them forward, not just from a revenue perspective. That falls along lines of innovation. It's about not only aggregating ideas, in this case that I'm referring to with this company is discreetly, they would have like a little box hanging on the wall that you would put ideas into, but also being able to foster those ideas. So they had a little, I guess you could say, advisory board for this entrepreneur that would meet with a select few group of people that represented someone in each department. And they would look at all of the ideas across the whole company and figure out how they can innovate and foster that those ideas and actually reward people for ideas that come to fruition. So that all plays as a part of innovation as well.
Yeah, that's really important. One of the things that we do is we've been doing, you know, quarterly offsites with our management team for years. But this year we just moved it to every department is now doing a quarterly offsite. So everybody in the company is involved in doing a quarterly offsite where they're reviewing their past achievements and bringing innovative ideas and then developing goals for what they want to do for our innovation. So that's one great. Of the ways we're trying to live that innovation is one of our core values. We're trying to live it out now in as best the way that we can. But you know, let's dig into this idea of innovation a little bit further. Can you be successful without innovation? Let's say you've been around, company's been around for 50 years. We make this product. It's great. Customers love us. We don't have to innovate, man. We're just making the same old thing. It's profitable. We're happy. It's all good. What's innovation for us? Can you have a company like that? Does that even make sense?
I mean, look, innovation isn't required. Just talk to Craig Newmark, who is the inventor of Craigslist. That website hasn't changed since I was a kid, since the internet started. It's still there and it's still relevant. And he's a billionaire, I think, as his valuation's in the billions. I mean, this guy has like refused to innovate. In fact, his refusal to innovate is an innovation within itself, I would argue to say. So no, you don't need innovation. Don't mistake innovation for growth. They're not one and the same. Innovation is a vehicle for growth, but it certainly isn't required within a company to foster growth at all.
Yeah, interesting. So if you do want to be a company that is tries to foster more innovation, you described one model of kind of having this entrepreneur, right, who's kind of fostering new ideas within the company. What is a way that you can become more innovative as a company? How can you kind of build that in? Maybe you're not trying to create the most unique idea out there, but you are trying to drive innovation throughout your company in all ways. What are some ways that you've seen or you've fostered within companies that you work with that can help move in that direction?
Yeah. Well, the easiest way for a startup is, number one, have some kind of policy, and it can even be a one pager that's publicly available on the role of innovation within the company. You're making it aware that there is a program available for your ideas to be fostered. And number two, make it known that that's available and have an outlet for those innovations to be fostered. I have a client who just has, they're spread out all over the world, and they just have this form. It's not a Google form because those you have to log into Google and wouldn't be anonymous in that way, but It's a form where you can fill out anonymously and have ideas, even if you think, you know, they always say no idea is too stupid, but some people are still afraid to put in ideas. So you could put in an anonymous form in your company, put it in your website somewhere or some kind of secret page where no one else can access it. And on your meetings, whether it's a weekly recurring meeting or just an ad hoc meeting that you're having, always make that a point of contention, or not a contention, but a point of communication, is that you can, this form is always here. We look at it weekly. As long as you're calling attention to it, that is the simplest form of having innovation in your company, is making it aware and available for everyone to participate in fostering ideas.
It sounds like you're talking about innovation as something that everybody can participate in the company. It's kind of a bottoms up approach. Is there a role for innovation that might be the top down approach? Think of the, you know, the Steve Jobs creating a Skunk Works, creating the next iPhone, you know, that kind of level of innovation, kind of reaching for that next unique idea or that big new product change or update. Is there a role for that, or is it best to really drive innovation in small incremental ways, kind of bottoms up?
I mean, it all depends. I mean, if you're talking about like a 10,000 person company, it's really hard to have innovation throughout the entire company, at least one cohesive innovation program, right? There's some companies I know that have innovation programs that differ from department to department, but ultimately innovation really should be a whole approach. It's almost like a couple is, you know, it's communication goes both ways. It's a teamwork. Innovation and teamwork go hand in hand. So yeah, you can have a top-down approach to it, but would it be as effective as, you know, specifically excluding certain people from or departments from that program? Maybe. It depends on what you're trying to innovate there. But ultimately, in my perspective, innovation should be a company-wide approach where everybody has an equal say into the program.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, and it gets everybody involved, and it probably gives you the best chance of success. So it's really,
and it's empowering.
Yeah. So you're making it part of your culture in many ways. So what is it about a culture that could kill innovation? You know, so what kind of cultures don't support innovation, and you know, and then how do you turn that around? I guess is the next point.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that can kill innovation the most is leadership, improper leadership. Unfortunately, and this is probably the number one reason why I'm hired as an entrepreneur coach, is that an owner of a company or a CEO would come to me and say, you know, I had this idea 3 years ago, 5 years ago, and I really just wanted to see it come to life. Now I've got employees and thousands of customers and everything's great. And I'm like, well, that's great. What are you complaining about? He's like, well, I'm not a leader. This isn't what I want to do. I was working with a $100 million company, tree service company. And the owner of the company did not like being the CEO, but he started with one man and a chainsaw 20 years ago, or two men and a chainsaw. And now he has hundreds of employees. He's, you know, worth $100 million. And he does not like or want anything to do with leadership. Hey, more power to you. The innovation killer is the boss that just, the old school boss, you know, I like to say, where, oh boy, the best example is like the generation gap is, I just talked about this the other day, is like when your father, you know, the old saying, wait till your father gets home, you're like that boss is going to wave your finger. He might break out his belt or whatever, you know? So they don't really do that nowadays, but that's the kind of old school boss where it's like, come to work at 8, leave at 5. Here's what I want you to do. Here's your task. You know, it's like very direct, bossy. That's not the innovation style type of company. So really proper leadership will foster innovation better than anything, any other type of quality within a company.
And as a CEO coach, how do you help those CEOs who are trying to change their culture to become more innovative when maybe they're not doing it themselves, or they don't have the right leadership team in place, or how do you kind of help them move in that direction when they maybe, let me ask the question a little bit differently. Let's say they built an organization that's not innovative because it's maybe they're not part of who they are. How do you kind of help them move in that direction?
I know. Well, first of all, changing the culture of a company is very difficult and requires steadfast resolution towards like, this is the goal and this is the way we're going to accomplish it. It requires cutting some key people across leadership. It's tough. And I've seen it before fail miserably. But if a CEO came to me and says, Mike, I want to start doing innovation, my company never done it before. There's a lot of different ways to approach innovation. It's just a matter of understanding the culture of the company, understanding their personality, understanding the way they want to approach innovation, and then executing a program that it's not just a one and done, executing a program that can be executed and revisited week after week, month after month, to track progress and goals until the culture, is changed. But installing innovation in an already existing company, especially the bigger the company, the more this applies, installing a innovation in a company that gets bigger over time, it becomes more and more difficult the bigger it is, yeah. The company is.
So I guess the lesson there is, if you're a small company, get innovation built into your culture early so you don't have to retool it later, because it sounds like that's crazy painful. My last question on innovation is it measurable? Do you think the companies that have innovation at their core are growing faster, more profitable, lower employee costs, all of that, than the non-innovative companies? Is there a business value, a return on investment to investing in an innovation culture?
Yeah, I mean, it is measurable. And that was a really tough part of my book. I'm flipping through the pages now because I want to see. Here we go. So it is measurable, but they're based, it's almost like, is branding measurable? Yeah, it is. But a lot of it is based on ideology and a whole bunch of other factors that isn't measurable, right? So in my book on innovation, there's three main components. It's communication, adaptability, and market fit. So within those three categories, there is, I'm just eyeballing, about 25 questions or so where you rank yourself from 1 to 10 and you can get a score. And then that score will tell you where your weaknesses and strengths are. So is there a way to measure it? Yeah, but it's through my subjective ranking system where you rank yourself. Now, the reason why I created the business success formula the way I did is because you could give that book to any one of your employees, not share each other's scores, and then aggregate your scores later and then see an even more aggregate score than you would if you just did it by yourself, right? So innovation really comes in handy when you have that. When you give this book, the business success formula, to a lower level manager and a C-level exec and see where the differences lie in the score, that's where you really start getting some feedback on how your innovation program or any other part of that score comes into play.
Yeah, very cool. So that's that sounds like an amazing tool for companies. Now, we started this conversation by saying you don't need a unique idea to win, but where we've really come around is you really need to build innovation. Maybe it's not a unique idea, but building innovation in your company gives you a much greater chance of success to win as an organization and be successful long-term. It's very interesting. So you don't need that unique one idea, but you got to kind of build it through the fabric of the company. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I've worked with lots of companies that are replicas of, you know, I have a company right now that's almost an exact replica of another company, but they're vastly different from the inside out, even though the end product is the same. I have a feeling based on what I know about one of them, they're going to scale a lot easier and faster because they're more nimble. They innovate, they execute better. Even though the product, the end result is the same, in 5 years, the companies are going to be vastly different, even in 2 years.
Yeah. Interesting. Very powerful. And your success formula and that diagnostic, especially on innovation, can be a really powerful tool for companies that are really trying to transform themselves and go in that direction. So if people want to learn more about your services or the book, how would they learn more about that?
Yeah. I mean, if you need a fractional CMO, that's what I do. And, you know, as you know, I write books, I'm an entrepreneur coach. So mikevolkin.com. You can get my business success formula right on Amazon or on the website.
Great. I'll order it this afternoon. Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate the conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk today. Thanks again.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye.